This is Lewis Lapham with The World in Time. My guest is Siddhartha Mukherjee, speaking with us today about the history and character of cancer, an ancient disease that presents itself as profoundly and terrifyingly modern. Your new book, Siddhartha, comes with the title The Emperor of All Maladies, and you approach the sovereign power of the illness both as a gifted writer and as a cancer physician and researcher at Columbia University Medical Center. You say that your book is a biography of cancer, an attempt to enter into the mind of the disease. How do you begin to tell so mystifying a story?
I think you begin by tracing its origins. I mean, the word biography really came to me while I was writing the book because I wanted to draw a portrait over time. And this idea of drawing a portrait, looking at cancer in every single facet through different aspects of it, really animated the book. And so part of the reason, part of the urgency of writing the book was, you know, it hadn't been done before. It really felt as if this history needed to be told.
You tell it wonderfully well. You describe it not only over time, but you also, out of your experience as a clinician and as a physician dealing with cancer patients.
Early on, while I was writing the book, one question was, well, whose viewpoint should this book be written from? Who should be the silent narrator, as you will? And it was very clear to me that narrator really, I mean, of course, there are many narrators in the story. One of them is me, one of them is my patients. But really, the fundamental person who's narrating the story is a patient carried through time. So the experience of the patient in 2500 BC, the experience of the patient in 500 BC, as well as in the 19th century and the 20th century. So this viewpoint keeps coming back over and over again. And as you obviously know, very often the book enters areas in which I ask the question, well, who was the first patient? What was it like to be treated with chemotherapy the first time? What was it like to experience surgery in the 19th century for cancer? What was cancer like, the experience of it? Over and over again, this keeps coming up.
Take us through a little of that chronology then. I mean, take us through the experience in ancient Egypt, ancient Rome, the Middle Ages, the 18th century.
The first time we encounter something that might be cancer is actually, interestingly, among the very first medical and surgical notebooks or textbooks that are available to human beings. And that's one of them is the Edwin Smith Papyrus. The papyrus was written around 2500 BC by an Egyptian scribe whom we know as Imhotep. And he describes about 50 odd cases. And each case it's very beautifully organized. It has a description of the case, an effort to provide prognosis and some treatment. And in one of these cases, case 45, he describes an illness that resembles cancer in many ways. So that's the first time we encounter it. It's very chilling, actually, as a contemporary oncologist reading that case, because under treatment, he has just a single sentence. He said, there is no treatment. He's describing a case of breast cancer. So that reminds us what it was probably like to be a patient in antiquity being diagnosed with a mystical disease, actually. And then the next time we encounter cancer, again, there are very few words for it. We encounter a case in Herodotus. Queen Atossa in Herodotus is diagnosed with a mysterious disease in her breast. Again, Herodotus doesn't have a word for it. And contemporary surgeons have debated whether this was cancer or not. Some people think that it was an abscess, but certainly it could have been cancer. It could have been inflammatory breast cancer in Queen Atossa. And the story, again, very evocative story, told very quickly in Herodotus, in which he says, well, Queen Atossa discovers this mass in her breast, and then she goes into hiding. She's so ashamed of it that she decides not to show it to anyone until it's actually spread throughout her breast. Again, very reminiscent of the disease inflammatory breast cancer. And she ultimately asks her Greek slave, Demosthenes, to help her cure the breast, which he probably does through a primitive mastectomy. And this moment, a very important moment for Atossa's life, and she then begs her husband, who's the king of Persia, to redirect his campaign effort, his war campaign, towards Greece, as opposed to towards the eastern border of Persia, which was Scythia. And in doing so, and that's because Demosthenes, the Greek slave to whom she was indebted, wants to return back to Greece. And in doing so, essentially launches the Greco-Persian War. And so I say in the book that even in a very quiet way, even before we know the word cancer, cancer leaves an incredibly important mark in the early history of the West.
And who gives it the name cancer?
So that word doesn't come up until, again, much later, and it's around the time of Hippocrates, the physician who begins to use the word cancer. The word is really carcinos or cancros, and a Greek for crab. And the reason is Hippocrates imagines the tumors like crabs, the lump, like a crab buried under the skin, and the blood vessels of the tumor like the legs of a crab spread out around it. And it's a very evocative name. It's also a reminder how incredibly metaphorically we've intercepted this disease throughout our history. Even the word itself is a metaphor.
It also connotes the pinching, the pain of the, of a pinching pain.
Absolutely. This metaphor, the word stuck because it connoted the pain, and it connoted, you know, the shell, the crustacean shell of the crab that was reminiscent of the impenetrability of some tumors. Even more contemporary metaphors, you know, the idea that cancers have a very unnatural movement, you might call it a lateral movement from one organ to another organ without seeming logic, again, reminiscent of the sideways movement of the crab.
And then we come to Galen in the first century AD, the famous Roman physician, and how does he understand cancer?
Galen inherits from the Greeks a general theory of physiology and pathology, which is based on four humors. Galen, the theory of four humors, is that the body, the normal human body, is made out of four humors: yellow bile, blood, black bile, and phlegm. And every body contains these four essential humors, and it's an imbalance of the humors that causes disease. And so every disease was therefore attributed to an excess or overabundance of a single one of these humors. So for instance, jaundice was an excess of black bile, hepatitis was an excess of yellow bile, and for cancer, Galen ascribed cancer to an excess of black bile. And actually, it's interesting, there's only one other disease which is ascribed an excess of black bile, and that is depression.
The most of what we've learned about cancer is in the late 19th and then the whole of the 20th century. And what do we now know? And why is the disease the one around which our fear of death seems to concentrate in the 20th century?
It was really the invention of the microscope that changed much of these theories. And what we now know, a long tradition that starts with the 19th century pathologists, including Rudolf Virchow, what we now know is that although cancer is not one disease, but many diseases, so a diverse family of diseases, but these diseases are connected quite deeply at a biological level. And at a fundamental sense, they are characterized by the abnormal growth, the unstoppable growth of cells, uncontrollable growth of cells. And so that's the fundamental feature. But although, as I point out in the book, that's just one feature that unifies cancers. There are actually several other features that cancers tend to share with each other. Then the second question is, well, why is it that that translates into this visceral fear and death? And that's partly because actually we don't know another disease like this. This is a disease in which essentially our own bodies have ceased to have control. Our own cells have ceased to have normal controls. Unlike, for instance, most infectious diseases where the agent often comes from outside. So therefore, I think there's a very complex relationship that we have with cancer because, again, it's an invasion from inside, as it were.
You refer to it as a doppelganger in the sense that we are all carrying around within us the burden of potential cancer. Is that fair?
It is very clear that the environment can unleash cancer. Tobacco smoke can unleash lung cancer, and other environmental causes for cancer have been found. But the most chilling realization and the most striking realization of cancer biology in the 1970s was that, in fact, the genes that ultimately unleash a cancer cell are genes that perform normal functions in the body. In other words, the very genes that allow our embryos to grow and our hands to grow and our brains to function and our bodies to become multicellular organisms, if you distort those very genes, you essentially unleash cancer. So in other words, cancer is not something exogenous to our cells, but in fact is a flaw or a distortion of normal growth. And that's why this idea of it being a malignant doppelganger, a kind of twin, is very much part of cancer itself.
Talk briefly about the so-called war on cancer in the middle of the 20th century, the 1950s, and our effort to contain, control, and ultimately defeat the disease.
The idea of the war on cancer really began to exert itself, as you say, from the 1950s, but really reached its peak in 1969 and 1970. And distilled into that idea was that if you put enough resources, if you put enough money and enough scientists in a very dogmatic and somewhat directed manner towards finding cures for cancer, then cancer would become curable, much like many other diseases had then become curable or preventable, such as polio or smallpox. Remember, this is a moment of time in American history that just emerged from the wars and the incredible success of the Manhattan Project in devising the atomic bomb, and then subsequently the incredible success of the Apollo projects in landing Americans on the moon. And so the idea crystallized that if you could somehow create a Manhattan Project for cancer or an Apollo Project for cancer, then it would the solution would just be found. And the emblematic moment of that was when the group that was really pushing for this warlike effort, directed programmatic effort, brought out an advertisement which said, in 1969, I reproduce it in the book, which reads, "Mr. Nixon, you can cure cancer." It splashed through hundreds of newspapers in December 1969. And again, inside that is contained all the optimism and the hubris. The word "you can cure cancer," as if it was one thing, the idea of cure, as if it was something that could be annihilated. And therefore, that really launched the war on cancer.
And how successful has that war been? I mean, we have spent enormous sums of money since, let's say, 1969, and great funds of intelligence in research. And where have we gotten to?
I would say we've gotten quite far, although there's a big skepticism and debate about this. Just let me address the question of money for one second, and that's an important question. People say, well, haven't we poured resources into cancer? The National Cancer Institute budget for this year is $5 billion. Just to give you a number in contrast, we spent $900 billion on these recent series of wars, military campaigns. Yes, absolutely, the $5 billion is a lot of money, but we certainly are spending vast amounts on other projects. Now, what have we got for that money? Well, we have gotten a 20-odd% reduction of mortality from breast cancer. We have changed the understanding of the cancer cell in a very fundamental way. We have got new drugs which have emerged from this process. But yet, on the other hand, diseases like pancreatic cancer, esophageal cancer, and one might even say lung cancer remain poorly understood and poorly treated and poorly prevented. So I would say that there's a mixed response. And in fact, there's a move in the community to wonder, and by the community I mean among oncologists, among scientists, among nurses, among patients advocacy groups, to start wondering whether, in fact, the biggest problem is calling it a war, whether we should actually reframe, again, our metaphors and call it something else. Harold Varmus at the National Cancer Institute said to me recently, well, it's more like a puzzle. You don't win or lose puzzles. You either solve them or you partially solve them. And I think that's a much better, more intelligent way to look at progress. We've certainly made progress, solved some puzzles, and yet some others don't remain unsolved.
You approach, as you say, from different angles over the course of the book, and one is the patient through time. How about the patient in the present, in terms of what have you learned from your own patients and their experience of the disease?
One interesting feature is how much history repeats itself and how densely the past keeps on recapitulating itself in contemporary medicine. In other words, the way that we treat patients today is radically different than the way that we might have treated someone 10 years ago or even 20 years ago. But the same mixture of optimism and nihilism and hubris and uncertainty plays itself out in so many different ways, such that my interaction with the patient in today's world carries very similar resonances and meanings as has been carried for the last decade or so. And by that I mean the dread of cancer, the complexity of it, the difficulty to deal with uncertainty, and the idea of what happens next. Every conversation is colored with that sense.
It is the leading cause of death in 2010 and will be more so in 2020, 2040?
Well, it's currently the second leading cause of death, lagging after heart disease. But there are predictions that it will actually overtake heart disease. Again, one must remember that we're talking about a family of diseases. But there are predictions that get cancer as a group will overtake heart disease as the leading cause of death by the next decade.
And partly that is because as one becomes older, one becomes more vulnerable to cancer, and therefore as people live longer, so do cancers.
That's right. That's right. I mean, I say that, you know, cancers emerge in the double negative. They only come out when all the killers have been killed. It's when, you know, smallpox and polio and other things have disappeared. Just as a reminder to put some figures to that, the average life expectancy of America in 1900 was, you know, 47 to 50. It has now climbed by at least two additional decades. And in fact, it's precisely those two decades when most cancers begin to occur.
Go back a little bit to the notion of the war on cancer, but take it in terms of the war between the individual and his or her doppelganger, that is to say, the presence of the disease within. Are there many variations in response as there would be with individuals?
Absolutely. There is no, just like there is no archetypal cancer, there is no archetypal host in whom the cancer is growing. And the responses are vastly different. I mean, we now know that the immune system, for instance, has an important role in some cancers. Lymphomas, for instance, there has a very strong role. And emergingly in melanomas, a cancer where the immune system plays a very, very distinct role. And by that, I mean that there is almost a cat and mouse game or a little battle going on with the immune system and the cancer cell, in particularly in those kinds of tumors. That's just one example, but there are dozens of other arenas in which the body and its response to cancer is just as individualized as the cancer's emergence in that body.
You tell in your book the story of one of your patients, Carla Reed, who's fighting cancer over a period of 5 years is an uplifting story. Tell us a little of that story and how amazing her victory really was.
So Carla is a patient of mine. I actually begin the book with her. And the reason I chose to begin the book with her is that her form of cancer, she had a form of leukemia, acute lymphoblastic leukemia, which is common in children and very curable in children, 60 to 80% curable in children. And in fact, it is acute lymphoblastic leukemia, the cure of acute lymphoblastic leukemia with high-dose chemotherapy, that really motivated the idea that one could win this war on cancer in the 1960s. The idea that you could take this one tumor and you could cure it with a combination of cytotoxic cell-killing chemotherapies launched the notion that a solution like this must exist for every kind of cancer, a kind of magic bullet for every kind of cancer. So in Carla's particular case, I chose Carla because she then becomes an illustration of this very idea. And yet, Carla, of course, is not a child. She's an adult. She's 36 years old. Her chances of survival actually drop from the 60 to 80% in children down to 20 or 30%. And so her battle takes on an incredible form. Her interception with chemotherapy, she obviously wants to survive, but in order to do so, she needs to marshal such incredible resources, personal resources. She almost has to abandon her friends, her family, in order to get through the what I call the crucible of chemotherapy. And one important note while I was writing this book was, I sometimes said, described it, I didn't know how this book would end in terms of Carla. I didn't know, for instance, if she would live or die at the end of the book, and therefore I didn't know whether this would be an uplifting or non-uplifting story. And it was a little bit like driving without a destination, sort of launching a journey, because that is the process. That was Carla's experience of it. She too was launching her journey with no certainty about where she would end up. And thankfully for her, and actually also because of the incredible medical care she received from a whole team of people, Carla lives. Right now. And it turns out that it is an uplifting story.
Over the course of time, the attitudes toward cancer, the hope of a cure, swing back and forth between hope and despair. Where do you end yourself at this point? On the side of hope or despair? Or how do you look into the future?
Well, I think I have measured hope. And by that, I mean, I think that the fundamental understanding of cancer cells will allow us in the future to convert many cancers into chronic diseases. I don't think that there will be a magic bullet or a penicillin for cancer, a single universal cure, because this is a disease of colossal diversity. I sometimes say that, you know, if you compare at the genetic level, even two breast cancers, there are vast differences between even two breast cancers. And of course, if you compare a breast cancer to a pancreatic cancer, those are even more different. So the idea that a single universal magic bullet was going to come and annihilate these diseases is unlikely to be true. But on the other hand, I think the wealth of information and the wealth of therapeutics and prevention that have emerged recently really make me hopeful in a measured way that many cancers, although not all of them, will be converted into chronic diseases over time.
You quote the poet Auden saying that every sickness is a musical problem and every cure a musical solution. And you have written a very beautiful book. In that sense, I think a very hopeful one. So thank you, Siddhartha Mukherjee, for speaking with us today about the history and character of cancer. I'm Lewis Lapham of Lapham's Quarterly for Bloomberg News. Copyright Bloomberg 2010.